life works, that you live just to die, that as long as you're alive, people you know, people you love, will die. That really, the best thing to do is never ever care about anyone.
Agatha?
Karen's calling to her from the line-up to pay for petrol. She looks harried.
Sorry, love, do you drive? Would you mind just scooching the car away from the gas pumps? God knows where Simon's got to. The keys should be in there. Sorry to be a pain.
Agatha stands to look outside. There's about 6 or 7 cars lined up, waiting their turn. One of them beeps their horn every now and then. The man behind the counter is having trouble with the computer system. Agatha looks back at Karen. If Agatha narrows her eyes into slits, Karen looks a little bit like Millie's mum. How do you tell your child that this is how life works?
You have to find a way, Agatha says, slinging her handbag over her shoulder.
Sorry,
Karen says, as Agatha walks toward the automatic doors.
I said, I can drive, Agatha says.
Ah, thanks, love, Karen smiles. Syme's probably found something else to pee on.
Probably, Agatha says.
She stops when she reaches the doors and turns to Karen.
Look.
The door opens behind her, and Agatha can feel the heat on her back.
I'm really very sorry.
Karen waves her apology away.
No harm done, love. The pie hardly cost a thing.
No,
Agatha says to herself as she walks out to the car. Not for that. Agatha opens the door and slides in. The keys are in the ignition. She cups them in her palm. They make a twinkling sound. She starts the car. She suddenly sees her face on a poster like Carl's. Wanted, and presses down on the accelerator. The thing is, she doesn't stop. She thinks of that hand-drawn car following the black arrow toward the Great Australian Pub, and she doesn't stop.
Well, she says to nobody, this is most definitely a 10.
12:17. And then she's driving on the highway. She, Agatha Panther, is driving a car on the highway in the middle of the desert. She doesn't go faster than 60 kilometres an hour, but she's driving.
I'm driving,
she says out the window.
I'm driving,
she yells to a council worker smoking by the side of the road.
No shit, lady, he calls back. I'm driving, she yells to a woman whose car appears to have broken down. Fuck you, the woman shouts. I'm driving,
she yells to the sky, to the birds. And nothing yells back. It's just wind in her face and the sound of that, the sound of rushing, rushing wind.
Good job, birds, she yells out the window. This road is particularly smooth.
She's holding on to the steering wheel with both hands and grinning at everything.
Boisterous letterbox. Perfect signage. Nice spots, cows. Good-looking trees. That cloud is smiling at me. Nice blue sky.
Agatha goes to adjust her glasses and they're not there. She sees them, in her mind's eye, on the sink in the service station bathroom. She tries not to blink and opens her eyes wider and wider, letting the cool air onto her eyeballs. She sees a sign by the side of the road.
Oh, she says,
and screeches the car to a halt in front of it. The Great Australian Pub, it says, and points down a long, straight dirt road that looks unending. She consults the map. Agatha gulps, finds the blinker, puts it on. Nice sound, blinker, she whispers, and turns left.
Carl the Touch Typist.
Well, we're going to die, Millie, Carl says.
They've been heading south through the desert for most of the day. The sun is still strong and hot overhead and their water is running low.
I've been trying to tell you, Millie says.
No, I mean sooner rather than later. Is that what you wanted, Agatha Panther?
He says up to the sky. Murderer! His voice doesn't echo, just disappears into the flatness of the surrounds.
I'm so thirsty.
He holds Manny in front of him and looks deep into his eyes.
Right, Manny, you understand. I hate this place. Australia. What kind of name is that? It's so dry. It's all the same, and it never ends, Manny.
He kicks at the dirt.
I hate this dirt. It's dirt. Who likes dirt?
No one, that's who.
I hate this sky. I hate this scrub. How you're supposed to live out here?
He kneels down on the ground, using Manny for support.
There's nothing out here,
he yells, and buries his head into Manny's chest.
Hurry up,
Millie says. Carl stands and continues to walk.
We're not going to get to Melbourne by tomorrow, Millie.
Yes, we are.
We'll never make it.
We're going to make it.
It's impossible.
You don't know everything,
Millie says, stopping suddenly.
Is that the pub over there?
She says, pointing. He squints in the direction of Millie's gesture.
Don't toy with me, Millie. I'm very thirsty. I think I'm getting dehydrated. You know what that means? It's one of the first stages of death.
There's a pub right there, she says, holding out the map. The one that Captain Everything told us about.
Well, I can't see anything.
Carl puts a hand on Millie's forehead, checking her temperature. Oh, God, he says. The heat's getting to you.
It's okay, Millie. We'll be okay.
He tries to lift her up to carry her, but she struggles against him.
I'm fine.
Millie pushes away from him.
Save your energy, Millie, Carl says.
Millie walks on ahead of him.
I said I'm fine.
Wait,
Carl says. There's a rumbling sound in the distance.
What's that?
A white car roars along a dirt road half a mile away, dust spraying behind it as though it's water skiing in a red lake.
A car, Carl says. It's a car, Millie. People.
The car starts to slow and then stops. Dust settles over the landscape, is drawn back into it as though it's breathing out and breathing in. It's then that Carl realizes he's looking at a building.
Is that?
Carl closes his eyes and then opens them again. It's still there.
Millie, it's a pub,
he calls after her. Carl holds Manny up and kisses him on the lips.
We're saved!
Carl has never been happier to see a building. It's brown, wooden, and has a chunky gaudiness that makes it look like a plaything, as if some giant kid had gathered together some old bits and bobs and superglued them together. The large rounded lettering on the sign attached to the roof reads, The Great Australian Pub.
This is the place,
Millie says, and disappears inside, though not before writing,
In here, Mum,
in the dirt, with her fingers. Carl has heard about the men who frequent these types of places, all leathery and quick to fight, thick hands and eyes permanently squinted from the sun, their sentences a few nouns and verbs bookended by swear words. He expects this to be a saloon moment. He'll walk in and everyone will turn around to look. The music will stop. A glass will break somewhere. Inexplicably, who will play him in a movie? He's just remembered that Paul Newman is dead. Is anyone he knows still alive? And, with a new burst of confidence, he will walk in with man shoulders, you know, pushed back, a proud chest, a man stride. These kinds of men can sniff out an imposter, but he is a man. He has faced death and defeated it. He has cheated death. He is a man. Everybody! A man, see, this man. He will walk over to the bar in two or three steps, pull out a bar stool and sit his man bum down, slam his man fist on the bar and order, no, not order, demand a double something or other. What would Paul Newman drink? And the entire pub would be looking at him and he would lean into the bartender and say, in a low, rumbly kind of voice, because someone who has power does not need to speak in a loud voice, make that a triple. Would there be a collective gasp? Maybe. But he wouldn't hear it, because he would be too busy being a man. And then the other men would rejoice in his presence, shake his hand, or high-five him, or whatever it is they do, and they would talk about man-things, like tools, and agriculture, and centerfolds. But when he opens the door, he realizes he will not make the bar in three steps.
Carl,
Why are you taking such big steps?
Millie whispers. What? Carl whispers back.
Does it look stupid?
Yes,
she says.
He walks to the bar in normal-sized steps. License plates from all over Australia line one wall like some kind of graveyard for dead registrations. There are 5 big-screen tellies scattered around the pub, and they all play the same AFL game on them. It's carpeted and dark. The ceiling is low, the air is dense. Dust swirls in the small patches of sunlight. There are 2 men sitting at the bar, chatting, and they barely notice him. The bartender is polishing glasses and nods in his direction. Carl nods back.
He knows, he thinks. He knows I'm a man.
He pulls out a bar stool. It scrapes loudly across the floor. He looks up at the barman.
Sorry,
he apologizes, doing something with his face that he doesn't normally do. Something very feminine, he can feel that much. He hates himself already. Carl leans Manny against the bar. The barman raises his eyebrows. Carl goes to sit down on the bar stool, but he's flustered with all the attention, with this pressure to be a man, and he misses the stool completely and falls backward onto his bum, and Manny comes crashing down on top of him, the noise from it all combining and echoing throughout the pub. The worst thing is not this, however. The worst thing is the noise that Carl makes, which involuntarily escapes his mouth like a volcano releasing toxic gas that's been building up for hundreds of years. A noise only very old men make when pushed to the end of their physical tether.
Oh!
It's the worst noise he's ever made. He's not even sure he could do it again, and he hears it as if he's standing outside of his own body. He lies on the ground for a few moments, reflecting on that small but satisfying moment in his life when these men thought he was one of them. He lets Manny's nose rest on his, closes his eyes and takes a deep breath.
You right, mate?
A voice says from above.
Yeah, need a hand, mate,
another voice says. And suddenly he's sitting at a bar with 2 men. Men! And they're slapping him on the back and laughing and ordering him a drink and asking, what's your story? And Carl cannot wipe the smile from his face.
Millie Bird. Millie sits with her back against Carl's stool. She fiddles with the hem on Manny's trousers, who has been positioned so that his back leans on the bar. The men say things about the footy, and Carl tries to join in. Yes, she hears Carl say, that young man should not have been replaced by that other young man. Millie reaches into her backpack for some food. But her hands fall on a folded piece of paper, nestled in there among the muesli bars. Captain Funeral, it says. She opens it. Dear Captain Funeral, on the day you left the train, we had a missed call from your mum's phone. Someone left a message. It wasn't your mum, though. I listened to it 16 times to make sure I wrote it down right. I've put it in a speech bubble so that you know it's not me talking. Mills, love, it's Auntie Judy. Where are you, love? We're looking for you. Your mum, she's not right, love. She's taken off. I sent Uncle Leith out west to get you, but you weren't there. He went all that way. Where are you, love? Just tell a policeman and stay where you are and we'll come and get you. Okay, love? Okay? Sorry for not telling you. I was afraid of making you sad. You can borrow my mum sometimes if you like. Yours sincerely, Captain Everything, Superhero, Indian Pacific. Millie folds the letter and puts it back in the bag. She holds on to her stomach. And then, hi, she hears. Millie leans forward and looks around Manny's leg. There's a girl sitting cross-legged against one of the other stools. She's about Millie's age, with straight black hair tied back in a ponytail. She has a box of matches in front of her. She lights one and watches it burn. Hi, Millie says back, eyeing the flame. Who's that? The girl asks, after the flame dies.
That's Carl, Millie says.
No, the girl says, not him. She points at Manny with the burnt match. Him.
Oh, Millie says. She clears her throat. Manny, he's dead.
The girl raises an eyebrow.
He's plastic. Yes, Millie says. Dead bodies turn into plastic and they use them in shops to sell clothes.
She looks at her fingers.
Is what I think.
The girl looks at her for a long time.
You're weird, she says finally. You're weird, Millie says. When my uncle died, my dad burned him.
The girl lights another match.
Then we threw him into the ocean. I'm sorry for your loss, Millie says quietly. Dead bodies stink, so then you have to burn them,
the girl says and looks at Millie.
Is what I know. Depends on how you think about things, Millie says uncertainly. No, it doesn't.
The girl crawls over to Millie and stares at her. She lights a match and holds it up between them. The flame makes shadows dance all over her face.
Let's burn him, she says, grinning. If he's dead anyway.
Millie feels a weight in her stomach. She watches the flame until it burns out. She looks at Carl behind her, who's laughing and telling a story in a much deeper voice than she has ever heard from him before. She looks back at Manny.
What are you afraid of?
The girl says, cocking her head at Millie.
Nothing, Millie says. I'm not afraid of anything.
But it isn't true because she is afraid of everything, and she feels that deeply in her stomach. The night before the first day of waiting. After her dad died, people in the town acted like they loved her.
Yes, Millie, they said. You poor love, they said. He's a lolly, they said.
But she knew it was because her dad was dead, and they were either, one, glad their dad wasn't dead, but were imagining it, but couldn't imagine it, or, two, their dad was dead too. So the ladies at the health food shop gave her all the glass jars they had, and the man at the hardware shop gave her as many tea light candles as she wanted. And she asked her mum, while she stared at the wall in the bedroom,
"When was Dad born?"
But her mum didn't answer, so Millie asked the lady at the library, who was surely the oldest person alive, and they worked it out by looking through all the old school photos in the archives. And they found one of her dad. His face leaner and brighter and clearer. But her dad, for sure. And after it went dark, she crept past her mum, who was on the couch, in her underwear, watching telly with the lights on. It was a hot, sticky night, and the cricket was on. But her mum didn't like the cricket, so Millie could tell her mum wasn't watching it. But her dad liked the cricket, so maybe that's why she was watching it. The glass jars were clinking around in Millie's backpack. But her mum didn't move. She hadn't moved the entire day, except when Millie bought her a bowl of grapes from the fridge and put it next to her. And she had patted Millie on the head. But when Millie walked past in the dark, all the grapes were still there. So Millie snuck out to the tree in the vacant lot. She climbed up and down the tree, attaching a glass jar with a burning tea light to every single branch. When she had finished that, she positioned some tea lights on the ground in front of the tree to spell out Dad. Beneath that, she lined up the remaining tea lights in a long line. It was the longest dash she had ever made. Millie lit all the candles and sat back on the grass. She lay on her front and made a pillow with her hands to rest her chin. The grass cracked beneath her, spiking her skin. It had been such a dry, hot summer. The candles in the tree gently swayed and those on the ground flickered. There were stars in the sky, and now it looked like there were stars in the tree and on the ground. As if Millie had made a starry night sky out of the whole world. She stood up and strolled around her sky, wondering if her dad was doing the same all the way up there. A gust of wind blew through the street, like it did those months ago when she held Spider in her hands. She heard the glass jars clink against the tree. She watched as some of the tea light candles on the ground toppled over, and she stumbled backward as she saw the grass catch fire. It started small, but then it was big, and then it was huge, and then the whole lot was on fire. Millie stood there. She watched it all happen. She watched the night sky disappear. She backed away to the footpath. The heat hurt her skin. Embers shot out. Glass jars cracked and burst. So she ran. She just ran. She found a tree farther down the street and climbed it right to the top. The street woke up and people appeared, and there were buckets of water and hoses, and the fire engines came, and Millie watched it all from the top of her secret spot, and no one knew she was there. When it was light again, Millie went home, because you always went home, didn't you? The police were there holding her bag, and her mum looked at Millie like her mum was only a drawing, and Millie's guts hurt, and she didn't know how to say sorry about it because it was the worst thing she'd ever done.
Well, the blackhead girl is saying, it happens so quickly. The girl lights a match, it burns so brightly.
And she holds it up to Manny's shirt, and Millie tries to say no, but it's too late, and the girl lights Manny's shirt on fire. Millie stands up and steps back, and the fire creeps up his shirt. Ba-boom, ba-boom, ba-boom. The flames climb higher, and it's the tree, and then she runs at him. She doesn't know how to put out the fire. She waves at it and blows at it, and she can feel the fire hot near her skin. And does she say, Dad? She doesn't remember. But it's her dad. It's her dad. And she watches the fire and curls up in a ball. Sorry, Mum. Sorry, Mum. Sorry, Mum.
Carl, the touch typist. Millie's on the floor, coughing. She looks up at Carl and he feels his heart ripped to shreds. Is there anything worse than seeing fear in a child's eyes? Manny is on fire. On fire! And the bartender hoses him down and it's out. There's another little girl. Where the hell did she come from? Why are there so many little girls all of a sudden? And she holds some matches. But Carl's brain doesn't make the connection yet, and he kneels down next to Millie. She coughs and cries, and he puts a hand on her cheek and then looks over at the little girl and says, "What did you do?" He knows he's not supposed to shout at little girls, especially ones he doesn't know, but it just happens, and she starts to cry too, but he doesn't care. And then one of the men says, "Wait a minute, mate, don't you yell at my daughter." And Carl knows the mate is being used ironically in this instance, and he wants to use it back in this way. Has he ever used it in this way? Has he ever used it at all? So he stands up and walks over to the man, and Carl is taller than him. That's got to be something, doesn't it? And he says, "Well, mate," he puts the extra emphasis on mate. It feels amazing out of his mouth. Will he be doing it again, if he lives through this? And then he says, "If your daughter wasn't such a criminal, then I wouldn't have to." And Scotty, or Jonesy, or Crusher, or whatever the man he was drinking and laughing with moments ago, has his hands around Carl's neck. And Carl pulls at the hands and chokes, but manages to lift a wobbly knee into the man's stomach. The man doubles over, and a bar stool clatters to the ground, and Carl puts his hands to his own neck. He never knew what it felt like to be strangled, and he is grateful for the experience. He says, "Sorry, mate." Scotty Jonesy Crusher looks up at him and growls at him. Growls at him, yes, he definitely growls, and lunges at Carl. And Carl somehow guesses the right way to move, and they stumble gracelessly around the pub. And Carl feels as if he dodges every lunge, hurdles chairs and small children, uses tables as shields. But really, if he's honest with himself, Scotty Jonesy Crusher is a bit on the chubby side, so he's easy to outrun. Then, in what Carl can only call a moment of distraction, surely every great man has one, he forgets to dodge, and Scotty Jonesy Crusher Fatty grabs his shirt and pulls Carl into him, and they slap each other a bit, elbows clunking, palms flailing, as if they're both trying to dig their way out of being buried alive. A white foam squirts from above them, somewhere. It covers them both, and they peel themselves away from each other, cough and splutter, cough and splutter. Carl reels backward and wipes the foam out of his eyes with his hands. The cut on his palm has reopened during the scuffle. Blood weeps from it, and Carl feels a little woozy, but then he looks up, and through the film of foam and red dirt and sweat, there is Agatha Panther. Hair
wild and unkempt, breathing heavily, holding a fire extinguisher with the raw animalism of someone in a ruthless war, presenting the extinguisher to them both as if it were the bloodied head of someone they knew, someone on their side, as if they were next. She looks so goddamn incredible that Carl cannot look away. "What have you done?" Agatha demands. And with everything that's been going on, he's forgotten about Millie. How could he forget about Millie? He points to the other little girl, cowering under a table in the far corner and still crying, and says, "Ask her!" Millie's still lying on the ground against the bar, her tiny body. And he thinks of Evie, her tiny body. "I will always be here, Evie." But Scotty Jonesy, Crusher Fatty, says, "Now, wait a minute, mate," and runs at Carl again, crouching down, grabbing him around the waist and pushing him into a wall. Agatha puts the fire extinguisher on them again. With as much poise as he can muster, Carl stands, wipes his face clean with his sleeve, and says, "I'm not your mate, mate." "Oh, shut up!" Agatha yells. "Everybody shut up! You!" She points at the bartender. "Get me some cold water." The bartender blinks at her. "Will?" The bartender hops on the spot, fumbles behind the bar, and hands her two large bottles of water. "Take them," Agatha says to Carl, so he does what she says, giving the bartender a tight smile. Agatha grunts as she leans down and hoists Millie up over her shoulder. "Everything hurts," Millie says between coughs. "I know," Agatha says, walking toward the entrance of the pub. Carl shuffles ahead of them and pushes the door open with his side. Agatha doesn't look at him as she passes him by. Carl follows her out into the parking lot and stops when she opens a car door.
"Whose is this?"
Agatha doesn't seem to hear him, or if she does, she ignores him. She lays Millie on the back seat and turns to Carl.
"Water,"
she says flatly, holding out her hand and snapping her fingers. Carl hands her a bottle and she snatches at it. He watches through the driver's side window as Agatha presses the bottle to Millie's lips.
"Drink, Millie," she says. "It'll make you feel much better."
Millie takes the water, sips at it, and closes her eyes. Carl remembers the fear in her eyes and feels a surge of protectiveness.
"You'll be okay, just Millie."
Agatha closes the car door and starts hitting Carl. "Hey," Carl says, shielding himself.
"You should have been watching her." "You can talk."
Agatha picks up a branch from the ground and comes at him, branch raised, ready to strike.
"Hey," Carl says, hiding behind a tree. "Just hang on.
You need to stop.
Stop right now. You are horrible. You hear me? You are the rudest person I've ever met. I bet your husband died on purpose."
Carl is shocked at himself. Shit. "Agatha, I didn't mean it like that. It came out wrong." Agatha begins to yell. Not words, just sound. It seems to start deep in her belly, and she screams it. Carl puts his hands over his ears because it's so loud, but there's nothing to echo off, so it just gets swallowed up and fades out into the sky. Agatha stamps her way over to Carl. She stands in front of him, close. He can feel her breath on his neck. They stand there looking at each other, square in the face. Carl has no idea what she's going to do. He shakes with the thought she is always mad, but he's never seen her like this. He does not know what she's capable of. She throws the branch over his head, and she grabs the back of his neck with both hands, and he almost screams, but she covers his lips with her lips, and she kisses him. It's not a long kiss, it's short and harsh and dry, but it's still a kiss. Agatha jerks her head back and crosses her arms, glaring at him. Carl stares at her, mouth wide open.
"So!"
Agatha yells. She turns on her heel and stomps back to the car. Agatha drives them down a long dirt road. Carl watches the dirt spread out behind them as if the car is pushing out rocket clouds, propelling itself along the ground. He twists in his seat and looks back at Millie. She's sound asleep, lying on her side, with Manny's newly melted arm around her waist. The world is too difficult for Millie, and he doesn't know how to tell her this. He wants to strap her to his back and show her beautiful things. He wants to stroll next to her while she walks on the tops of brick walls.
and he wants to point out how there is music to everything if you just close your eyes and watch the notes in your brain. He wants her to know how satisfying it is to put a book that you've just read back on the shelf. And words. He wants to show her, beautiful words, how much beauty there can be on a page. And he wants to show her everything good, and he never, ever wants her to see anything bad. He turns back to face the front.
"Where did you get the car?" he asks.
Agatha doesn't answer. He pushes the door lock up, down, up, down. He thinks about the kiss. It is the sexiest thing that has ever happened to him. Beer and dirt and fighting and a woman grabbing his neck and kissing him on the lips in front of everybody. And the way she holds the steering wheel, like she is holding it, like someone who knows how to hold things. And the way she watches the road with those steely eyes, as though she is ready for anything, a kangaroo or a snake or Armageddon. And the way she doesn't squeal when she hits rabbits. And the way she does up her buttons right to her neck, like no one, not ever, is getting in there. Agatha looks over at him and he winks at her. "What's wrong with your eye?" "Nothing," Carl says. He stares out the window, feeling the gentle rumble of the car against his legs. "There's really nothing out here, is there?" He presses his face against the window. Agatha doesn't answer straight away. Keeps her eyes on the road and her hands tight on the steering wheel. But then... "Everything's out here," she replies.
Millie Bird. When Millie wakes, the car has stopped and it's dark and the doors are opening and closing. She'll be slam. We'll just, not more than, slam, okay? Carl opens the back door and puts a towel over Millie's legs.
"Are we in Melbourne?"
Millie says. "No, Millie," Carl says. Carl hugs her and it feels like her dad is hugging her, and she whispers,
"Did I dream him?"
And Carl says,
"Who?"
And Millie says,
"Did I make him up?"
Because she's sure she did. But Carl says, "No, Millie." And then, "We'll be right back, just Millie." And he closes the door and it's so dark and she says,
"Am I dead?"
But there's no answer because they're gone already and everyone's always leaving and her question just hangs in the dark in front of her, like a skeleton in a horror house. And she sits up and watches them walk away and then she hugs Manny into her and squeezes her eyes shut.
Agatha and Carl. Morning-ish, Agatha Standard Time. The sun is coming up. That moment when it's not night and it's not day. Agatha's not missing it this morning. They hear the ocean smashing into the cliffs. They stand in the shrubs, a few hundred meters away from the car, facing each other. Carl puts a hand on Agatha's cheek. The feeling is not unpleasant.
"Your cheek is so soft," he yells suddenly.
Agatha smiles.
"Your hand feels nice," she yells back. "I'm going to put my other hand on your other cheek," Carl yells. "I'd like that."
Carl moves in closer and holds Agatha's face in his hands. He can't really see her because it's still dark and his eyes are terrible. But he can feel the heat of her, and he loves her skin on his hands.
"You smell good," he yells. She yells back, "I think you should take off your shirt."
He steps back and undoes the buttons on his shirt.
"You should take off your jacket," he yells, throwing his shirt to the side.
Agatha undoes the buttons on her jacket and drops it on top of his shirt.
"Skinny arms," she yells at him. "Yes," he says, looking down at them.
He looks back up at her.
"Smooth neck. Undershirt," she yells.
He pulls his undershirt up over his head and throws it to the side with the other clothes. His hair is spiky on top of his head.
"Blouse. I can see your ribs, she yells as she unbuttons her blouse. Shoes! I can see your bra strap, he yells while stooping down and untying his shoelaces. Shoes! Relatively inoffensive chest. Socks. I want to rub your feet. Stockings. I'd like to put my head on your chest. Trousers. Strong calves. Skirt.
And then they're both standing in their underwear. They look shocked to see each other. The light warms up around them. They're both becoming more than blurry silhouettes to each other. Carl stands in front of Agatha, wearing nothing but his boxer shorts. He is so skinny, hair growing across his chest in fits and bursts. Skin droops from his arms, around his nipples, and around his elbows in sad U-shapes, like someone is pinching them downward. She moves toward him until she's so close she can see the hairs on his chest shifting and moving with every breath she exhales. Agatha lets Carl look at her. She is all clumps and bulges and rolls, and there's just so much flesh there that he wants to push his face into all of it. She wears a bra that means business, one that you could probably attach to trucks to tow them out of trouble if you were in a bind. Her stomach bulges out over her slip, and there's fat sneaking out the sides of her bra. With a bit of difficulty, she sits on the ground, her legs out in front of her. Carl, with a similar amount of difficulty, does the same. They lean in toward each other, their faces hovering, so close. They both notice more wrinkles on the other's face. Agatha notices more ear hair than she first thought. Carl notices a hair growing out of Agatha's chin. They close their eyes and kiss. And then they do it. Because even old people call it it. It's not classy, or something you'd want to see close-ups of. Nothing works the way it should, and they get red dirt up their noses and have to take a break to clear them, and Agatha keeps her bra on because it has been a big day of new things and you've got to stop somewhere. And they have to work out which parts of their bodies still work and those that don't. They have to spend a long time working each other out. Is this okay? Carl says. And, is this okay? Agatha says. And it is too slow and too fast. And they never get it quite right. It is not good, but it is warm and thrilling in its way. And Carl makes as many very old man noises as he pleases, and Agatha is quiet for the first time in a very long time, and Carl says, "Aren't we lucky to have hands?" Because he just loves the feeling of grabbing her stomach, and Agatha nods, because she loves the feeling of being grabbed, and Carl sits up suddenly, the typewriter letters from Evie falling into place in his mind, and says, "Go for it." And Agatha says, "I am." And Carl says, "No. I mean, that's what..." And he almost says Evie's name. And wouldn't that be a big mistake? So he lies down and says, "Forget it." And Agatha seems to. As the sun rises and warms and yellows, they know they should be playing mahjong and sitting in chairs and making tea and writing letters to grandchildren. They should not be having sex in the desert, but they are. And it makes them feel like movie stars, because surely only movie stars do things like have sex on a cliff as the sun rises. And Carl thinks, "I could play me in a movie. I am better than Paul Newman. He is dead, and I'm alive. I'm alive!" And their skin, it feels amazing against the fresh air. There is beauty in the entitlement they feel. They have lived long and deserve this moment, and everything flaps and flies and wobbles and jiggles and sags, and it's like flying, sort of. And Agatha can't stop holding her arms up to feel the air on them. It is such a true feeling, and Carl can't stop looking at her, and they look each other in the eye for a long time, and Agatha has never felt this good in her body before. She has never felt like it was right to be in it, and she does not speak. She cannot speak. And later, after they've done it, they sit against each other, feeling the cold dirt on their skin, holding each other up, watching the sun prepare to start a new day. Agatha says, "I loved him, you know, Ron." "I know," Carl replies, as he writes, "Carl and Agatha was here," in the dirt around them.
Millie Bird. Millie wakes up, pinches herself. She's not dead. She looks at Manny. He is all melted. She runs her fingers over his face. His shirt is stuck to his body. She holds her beer cozy in front of her and stares at it. Traces her finger around the edges of Australia. She wonders where she is right now. And imagines a pulsing red light blinking at her on the beer cozy. And a neon sign, "You are here." She gets out of the car and walks around it.
"Carl?"
she says, looking under it. She climbs onto the roof.
"Agatha?"
she says. The sun is starting to light things up. They're parked near a huge cliff. She stands at the cliff edge and feels the wind so strong against her clothes, rippling them like water. Her cape flies out behind her, and she sticks her arms out in front of her, like she's preparing to fly. The drop to the ocean is so far below. There is so much space out here. The sound of the waves against the cliff and the rocks is deafening. She's surprised to see a man on the edge of the cliff, about 50 meters away. He's facing away from her and hits golf balls into the water. She watches him for a few minutes, watches him swing far up behind his shoulder and follow through. Watches the ball move so far, so high, and then drop, all the way through that space and into the ocean. She wonders what it would feel like to be that ball. She imagines flying through the air, her cape billowing out, and then dropping, dropping so fast, losing her stomach, and plunging into the ocean, the water swallowing her up. She walks up next to him.
"You're gonna die, you know,"
she says.
"Shit!"
He jumps, turning toward her, his golf club raised. "Bloody hell, love!" He scans the area behind her. "You just crash-land your alien ship or something."
"No. How long till Melbourne?"
"Where's Mum and Dad?"
"How many kilometres, exactly?"
"Oh, geez, love. Ages, I don't know. About 1,500 k's?"
"Will you take me there? I have something very important to do there today."
"Nah, love," he says. "Go on the other way."
"Okay,"
she says, sighing, turning, walking away, because she is so sick of grown-ups and their promises and the fact that they never do anything for you. And she decides that she is most definitely going to do every single little thing on her own. Because she is the only one she can trust, and she knows that whatever she says in her head, she will do. And that words people say can go either way. They can be true or they can be false. She is sick of it, sick of it, sick of it! She knows Carl and Agatha have gone off somewhere and left her. She knows her mum doesn't want to be found, but she doesn't care. She is Captain Funeral and she is the boss of herself. "You all right, love? Where's Mum and Dad?" "They're dead. You wouldn't know. You're just an adult." She opens the car door and climbs onto Manny, kissing him softly on the forehead, like her dad used to do to her, and she drags him out of the car and towards the edge of the cliff. His body makes lines in the ground, and red dust sparkles in the morning light. She is going to fly him to Melbourne. She will do it. She will do it right now, because no one else is going to do it. No one else is going to help her. She is going to have to be strong. She will hold him under one arm, and she will jump. And she'll fly up in the air like a golf ball,
but she'll keep going, and Carl and Agatha and her mum will be sorry. They will be very, very sorry, and they will all say, "Sorry, Millie, sorry, Millie, sorry, Millie, sorry, Millie, we are so sorry, Millie!"
Agatha and Carl and Millie. Carl and Agatha return to the car like teenagers. Carl actually slaps Agatha on the bum, and she actually giggles. They are caked in red dirt. Their hair sticks out at odd angles. The air shakes between them when they look at each other, and Agatha feels like women would be jealous of her. And really, that's all she's ever wanted. But then... "Millie?" Carl says when he reaches the door. He turns around. "Millie!" he shouts. Agatha puts her face against the car window. "Millie!" she breathes into the glass. "Millie!" she yells in the other direction. They run around the car in circles, checking underneath and on top of it. They both keep saying "Millie" as if it's the final word in a magic spell. She's nowhere to be seen, and it's so flat out there. Agatha turns around and around on the spot, scanning the landscape, willing Millie's shape to appear in front of her. Agatha looks toward the cliff and has to lean onto the bonnet of the car for support because the thought has arrived in her mind with a near-collapsing suddenness. That's it, out there. That's where she is. That's the only place. The unsurvivableness of out there is what makes her knees buckle. Carl spots a man, a golf club resting on his shoulder, walking toward them with a relaxed gait that seems disrespectful. "Excuse me," Carl says and runs over to him. "Have you seen a little girl?" He holds his hand out to his side to indicate her height. In the wind, all Agatha can hear the man say is "Melbourne" and "Odd" and "Dragging something toward them cliffs." She watches Carl grab the man's collar and say, "Why didn't you stop her?" And the man push Carl in his chest and say, "Hands off, mate!" So Agatha takes a big breath and walks towards the cliff edge. Agatha walks as fast as her fear will let her. She can hear the men yelling at each other behind her, and she is tired of yelling. So very tired of loud noises coming from people's mouths, especially her own. And the ocean is so enormous in front of her. It is so endless. Even when it looks like it ends, she knows it doesn't. She stops a couple of meters from the edge, kneels down, and lies on her stomach. She pulls herself forward, feeling the gravel scraping her legs. She grunts with the effort. She grabs the edge with both hands and peers over it. "Millie!" she calls, but it's lost in the wind. She says it over and over again, as if trying to wake Millie from a deep sleep. Agatha scans the ocean for any signs of her, but there are none. And she has killed her. She has killed this tiny girl, and it is her fault. It is her fault, and she buries her face in the dirt and sobs. But...
"Agatha?"
Agatha shoots her head up, looks toward the voice. There is something there, but without her glasses she can't make anything out properly.
"Millie!" "Agatha!"
Someone replies faintly, and it has to be Millie's voice. So Agatha crawls along the cliff edge towards the voice. And then she sees her, clutching that plastic man, standing on a small ledge jutting out from under the cliff edge, like a sulky bottom lip.
"Millie!"
Agatha doesn't know what else to say. What do you say? How do you ever know what to say? Millie looks up at her. She's crying. Agatha has never seen her look so wild.
"Rack off, Agatha," she says. "I don't need you. I'm fine on my own."
"I'm sorry, Millie," Agatha says, crawling closer. The ledge looks unstable, like it could break off at any moment.
"No, you're not."
"Don't move," Agatha says. She looks behind her for Carl's help, but he's still arguing with the stranger.
"Agatha Panther,"
Millie says, turning away from her. "No," Agatha says, "I'm not."
"You'll just leave me."
Agatha looks toward the car again, wishing Carl would come, wishing for his help. The drop to the ocean is making her dizzy. Forcing herself to look down, Agatha says.
That's true. I will one day. That's what life is, Millie.
The air is crisp and cold and the noise of the ocean is so overpowering.
But while we're both alive, wouldn't it be nice to be friends? I'm doing it, Agatha, Millie says. And you can't stop me. No one can.
No, Millie, Agatha says. And she doesn't even think. Her body just does. She will think later. Is this what it feels like to have a child? To do without thinking? To be so outside of your own body and so inside of theirs? She slides herself down onto the ledge, scraping her legs and arms, but she doesn't feel it. Because she's trying to keep her eye on Millie, trying to grab her, just to get to her. But Agatha is so far away. She will never reach her. She's on her hands and knees and she tries to yell out to her, but the words won't come. Her throat feels like it's closing, and she watches helplessly as Millie hugs that stupid plastic man to her and takes a step toward the ocean. And Agatha shuts her eyes and stops breathing altogether, and hopes you can die from making yourself stop breathing because there's nothing else left to do. But after a few long seconds of holding her breath, she feels a warmth next to her. Agatha opens her eyes, and Millie is there, standing right next to her, looking down at the ocean. Agatha follows her gaze, and it's that plastic man, falling, falling, falling. Millie's cape is tied around his neck, and for a moment it looks like he's flying. He hits the ocean with a tiny splash and then bobs to the surface. Agatha sits up and takes a deep breath, one that inhales and doesn't just breathe, one that takes in all the atoms from this moment and keeps them in her lungs. Millie wipes her eyes with her sleeve and sits down next to Agatha.
What does abandoned mean?
There's a smattering of peaks in the ocean, like a classroom of children raising their hands. Agatha pauses. Every thought, every breath, every movement feels so important in this landscape. Words seem to count more.
Left behind, she replies.
Lost?
Sort of.
Without looking at Millie, Agatha reaches for her hand and holds it really, really tight. When Carl finds them, his shirt is ripped and his hair is all mussed up. He helps them climb up the ledge and hugs them both. Agatha relays the fate of his plastic companion. Carl feigns indifference. Millie informs him that they can share Manny's leg, and this seems an agreeable thing to Carl. They all pile into the car and drive away from the bight, feeling the presence of one another amid the drama of the landscape. Agatha listens to the quiet. Millie puts her hand on her reflection hand in the window, and Carl smiles because he's written, "We are here," in the dust on the bonnet. Things that Millie, Carl, and Agatha can't know for sure. 10 years from now, Agatha will sit at Carl's hospital bed and watch his life end in front of her. Millie will be in a different country and will miss it. But she will return for the funeral. In her eulogy, she will say, "Carl is my best friend." And she will use the present tense on purpose. Agatha will die 3 months later, and it will be Millie who finds her, dead in her armchair, and Millie will believe she looks happy sad. Millie will die too, eventually. Like everything does, leaving behind an ex-husband and 2 grown children. It will be an accident, it will be quick, and her last thought will not be a thought at all. What will I... But they don't know any of this yet. Because for now, Millie, Carl, and Agatha drive back the way they came.
We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Lost and Found by Brooke Davis. Text copyright 2015 by Brooke Davis. Production copyright 2015, Random House Audio UK. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.